that's basically that. All right, like I said, I am Kerry Sullivan, and we are here with the TriathlonSummit.com, and this evening we got Terry Laughlin online, who is the founder of Total Immersion. I'm just going to give Terry a little bit of an introduction here, and Terry was a swimmer for most of his life and a collegiate swimmer, and then after graduating college, he went on to become a head coach at the ripe age of 21. From there, as 16 years as a collegiate coach, his athletes won 14 individual and relay titles at NCAA Division III, National YMCA, and U.S. Junior National Championships, and every team that he coached performed far better than they had before. He also helped some swimmers qualify for the Olympic trials in 1980, 84, and 88, and produced a number of world-ranked swimmers as well. From there, he went on and took these experiences from what he learned, and he developed Total Immersion. So with that, let's bring Terry Laughlin to the line. How you doing, Terry?
I'm super, Kerry. Good to be here.
Good, good. Well, very, very happy to have you here. So let's start off with asking you some questions here. So how did you start Total Immersion?
Well, actually, you mentioned my swimming background. I was a pretty undistinguished swimmer, the first time I tried out for a swim team was in eighth grade, and I actually didn't make the team. I was the only person I think they ever cut from that team. And then I swam in high school without any particular distinction. In college, I did a little better as a distance swimmer. But when I went to coaching, I had this sense that hard work might not be the only answer to swimming well. So I was always a coach that was pretty oriented to teaching and really drawn to the aesthetic part of the stroke. In other words, while other coaches were focused on the pace clock, I was really fascinated by how people swimming looked and associated performance more with a certain look in the stroke and really worked more on trying to make people look like better swimmers that I was either coaching or I'd seen. So I had coached from 1972 through 1988 with a real teaching orientation. And then in 1988, I was feeling a little burned out, not from the coaching, but from dealing with swim parents. And I started, I decided I was going to offer a camp for adults. The summer of 1989, I offered a camp for adults. And I did that because not too many other people were focusing on that. There were a lot of camps for kids, but I didn't see much offered for adults. And I thought that in a camp setting, I could really do the part of coaching I liked a lot, which was to teach. So the first Total Immersion camp was kind of like a summer camp for adults in July of 1989, and I had six people come to it, and they were all master swimmers. And you know, we taught all the strokes and everything, and I enjoyed that. And then I did another camp the following week, and I had about the same number, and so on. So that was the start. And I just had the two camps in 1989, and then I wasn't coaching. I was coaching at West Point. I was an assistant coach with the swim team at West Point during that time. And then in the summer of 1990, I did a few more camps. There really wasn't any Total Immersion in between the summer of 89 and the summer of 90, but I did a few more camps in the summer of 1990. And in 1990, I got a few triathletes for the first time. And over the next couple of years, we started to see more triathletes at the camp. And that really was a challenge to me for a couple of reasons. That first of all, they mainly wanted to work on freestyle. They weren't all that interested in the other strokes, and I really had my heart set on teaching all the strokes. And the second reason was that when we finished a pool session, they ran outside and got on their bikes and went out for a bike ride, and they would come back for the next pool session with their tongues hanging out. So I wasn't that thrilled in the beginning with having triathletes come to my camp, because it was kind of changing it from what I thought I wanted it to be doing there. But as the sport grew in popularity in the early 90s, and I started to see a lot more triathletes, and it became really evident that the greatest appetite was for programs, you know, to focus on freestyle, two things happened that really led to what Total Immersion eventually became. We started to offer freestyle-only programs, and eventually stopped doing programs for the other strokes because there just wasn't as much of a call for that. I mean, we still occasionally do have programs, camps, and so on where we teach the other strokes, but 98% of our, you know, our workshops and so on are really focused on freestyle. So we became a program that focused very heavily on teaching freestyle. And the second thing was, I was really so much more challenged by coaching triathletes and teaching triathletes, because the master swimmers that had come initially were people much like me. They had been swimming since childhood. They were pretty comfortable in the water. They had a reasonable base of skill and, you know, self-awareness in the water, whereas triathletes were really uncomfortable. They had very little experience in swimming, and the stuff that I was used to using with swimmers, the drills and so on that I had done for, you know, almost 20 years at that point as a coach, were not working as well. So I was forced to find some new ways of teaching, and it was really absolutely non-negotiable that we had to spend time with getting them comfortable in the water. And from that point, I started developing a new way of teaching that was based on having people, you know, I guess the best way to put it is develop a relationship with the water before worrying about locomotion, you know, in other words, before worrying about getting to that end of the pool,
right.
To think about just issues like I really hate this feeling that I'm sinking, and things like that. So we ended up, you know, coming up with a different way of teaching swimming that really would inverted what was the traditional way and really downplayed pulling and kicking in favor of first getting comfortable, which, you know, in a more formal way we call balance, and then a focus on reducing drag, being more streamlined and more aligned. So a lot of body position things with pulling and kicking only being introduced when they were comfortable in the water, when they were aligned, when they were balanced, when they were a little more stable, and so on. And the upshot of that was that when we started teaching in this new way, where locomotion became secondary to body position and drag avoidance and so on, the progress shown by the people we were teaching was unprecedented. I had not ever seen swimmers progress.
Hello? Hello?
The moderator has disconnected. The call will now end. To the conferencing service, please enter your conference ID followed by the pound sign. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Incorrect conference ID. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Conference ID accepted. You will now be placed into conference. The call will now end. Welcome to the conferencing service. Please enter your conference ID followed by the pound sign. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Incorrect conference ID. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Conference ID accepted. The moderator has not yet arrived. Please wait. You will now be placed into conference.
Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Hello? Terry.
Yeah, we lost the connection.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I got bounced off. Did you?
Yep. Yeah, but all right, but we're back. Sorry
about
that.
Yeah, we're back anyway. It's still recording. We're going to put the recording up for them. So that is that. So you finished on. Can you hear me still, Terry?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll continue on to the next question there. So not exactly sure what happened there, but we're back in action here.
Yeah. All right. So basically, I think when I stopped hearing the beep and then I realized maybe I was speaking into dead air. But basically what was going on was we were seeing such remarkable improvement, something we'd never seen before in our coaching experience, that ended up writing a book describing what it was. And that was the Total Immersion book, and it's gone on to become the best-selling book on swimming in the world. So that's how Total Immersion started.
Yeah, you've gone global. Good stuff. All right. Let's get into first question here that we got for you. And basically, what's the relative importance of technique versus conditioning in swimming?
I think what we were seeing, in the camps that was really so surprising to us, that where the improvement was so great, was an indication of something. It certainly convinced me that technique was really far more important, because these people that I was working with were all highly conditioned athletes. They were triathletes when they came in, and they were swimming very poorly, and they had no quote-unquote endurance in the water. And when we taught them changes in technique, it made a huge difference. I didn't really fully understand the significance of technique in swimming. I've been teaching it for many years, but then last year at this time, there was an article in Popular Mechanics, and it talked about a group of physicists and engineers who were given a project by the Defense Department to design a swim foil for the Navy SEAL. And in the course of their research for that, they found out that human swimmers on average are 3% efficient. In other words, 97% of our horsepower and energy get diverted into something other than forward propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
Even for elite swimmers, Michael Phelps is only not quite 10% energy efficient. So even he's wasting over 90%.
Right.
And that's just a mind-boggling number, to realize that while you're working on fitness, well over 90% is going to waste when you're in the pool. So I saw that when I saw that article, I did a web search. I just typed the search term energy efficiency in, and then I put in all the land sports, running and cycling and cross-country skiing and so on. And the range of energy efficiency among elite athletes in those sports was between about 23 and 36%, as compared to less than 10% for the elite swimmers. But what was even more striking was that the differential between the recreational athlete and the elite in the land sports was only 10 to 20%, whereas the differential between the recreational athlete and elite athletes in swimming and energy efficiency was 300%. So that was really a big thing, you know, to see that number. So it's clear that the solution to swimming well, when you understand those numbers, is not getting fitter, and what it really is reducing energy waste. So, you know, and reducing energy waste, that's what technique is.
Yeah.
So
very interesting.
That's the significance.
Oh yeah, that's huge. I mean, so that's huge. So then, you know, how important is drag reduction compared to propulsion in swimming then?
Well, you know, that ends up being the main issue when you consider what's the reason why we're wasting 97% of energy. And I would guess that most new triathletes are probably in that 3% range. So if Michael Phelps is 9%, a new triathlete who's got no swimming experience at all is probably in the 3% to maybe 4% range. And when they get to the point where they can actually swim a mile nonstop, they probably raise their efficiency to maybe 5% or so. And so the things that are to blame for that waste, you know, well, there are several causes. You know, one is the fact that we're sinking. One is the fact that we're unstable. The fact that we have very poor traction. You know, we try to push on the water and it just swirls away. But the main one is that water is about 1,000 times denser than air is. And when you start thinking about anything that moves fast through either of those mediums, so we're, you know, even in quote unquote thin air, if you're designing something that needs to move fast, like a bullet or a spear or a bullet train, it's really streamlined, and triathletes know that, you know, so that's the reason for aero bars and aero positions and so on, because our velocity on a bicycle is significantly greater than it is while running, that they spend a lot of money to reduce drag on a bicycle, and that's thin air. So, you know, once you get into a medium that's 1,000 times denser, it really should become very, very obvious that drag avoidance is a huge issue. And what this really comes down to is if you think about the average person who's standing at the starting line of a race or who's just standing at the end of the pool and wanting to get from this end to that end, what, you know, what's going through their mind? Are they thinking about avoiding drag in the next period, whether it's the next 20 seconds that it'll take to cross the pool, or the next, you know, between 15 minutes and 2 hours and 15 minutes that they'll be swimming? I mean, how much of an Ironman swim do you suppose the average person is really aware of drag awareness, drag avoidance, versus pulling and kicking?
Probably, yeah, very little. Very little.
There's not much. Yeah, there's not much thought given to that. So our instincts are so strong on the pulling and kicking side, and that's really the big, you know, sort of eye-opening insight that I think is really critical to triathletes. So, you know, one way of looking at this is and understanding why humans are experience so much difficulty in swimming is just to think about the difference between anything that is designed to move through those mediums fast. So basically the fuselage shape is the one that has been designed for speed in air or water. And a human body is really shaped nothing like that. A fuselage has a tapered leading edge, and then what follows it is smooth and sleek. And the human body is all angles, you know, a head that moves around and arms and legs that stick out and hips and shoulders and all that, you know. And as soon as you start moving, and especially if you're uncomfortable in the water and you're a little prone to doing what, you know, what I call survival stroking, it's just massive bubbles and turbulence and waves being created and so on. and not a lot of locomotion. So, you know, so what we've really started to do in teaching is to get people to be thinking in terms of, you know, a really kind of a concept that will seem very strange at the outset, but is, you know, makes a lot of sense in a fluid medium, is that the more important role of your hand is to separate water molecules gradually. You know, that's what the tip of a fuselage does, is it separates molecules gradually so that the rest of it can go through smoothly. And so basically what it boils down to, there's an awful lot of detail beyond that, but the technique that we're trying to get people to adopt is to focus more on separating the water molecules in front of you than pushing on those behind you. So that's drag reduction versus propulsion. You still do the propelling part, but it's a case of, you know, what are you going to be thinking a little bit more about while you're swimming?
Yeah, and that's great stuff. And if you guys want to get some more information on like some of these techniques and things like that, obviously Terry's site is a great resource for that, and that's at totalimmersion.net. And in particular for triathletes, he just came out with a great new DVD called Outside the Box, a Total Immersion Program for Success in Open Water. You can definitely get that at totalimmersion.net, right, Terry?
That's right.
Great. And then basically the next question that I'm going to ask you is, how, in terms of relaxation when you're swimming, how important is that?
Well, I've been swimming open water for 30 years myself, and I'm 57 now. And I happen to mention earlier that when I was in my teens and 20s, I really was not very successful. I you might say I was an underachiever. And at the time, I was really focused, dedicated to being the hardest working swimmer in the pool. You know, anytime I was in workout, I was really determined to outwork everybody around me and to be the first one at in the pool and the last one out and so on. Never missed a workout. Just got out of every one with my tongue hanging out. And yet I really experienced very little success. When I started coaching in my 20s, I really started, especially because I was on deck and getting to watch from on deck instead of just kind of being in the water in a haze of pain all the time, I became more aware of the importance of technique and began to understand it better. And as I taught it, I understood it better. And certainly, I practiced all that on myself. So in my 20s and 30s, I was really focused on becoming a technically better swimmer. In my 40s, I took that to a somewhat more level, and I was really focused on overall mastery as a swimmer, not just better technique, but really more self-awareness and stuff like that. When I got into my 50s, and I'm 57 now, as I said, when I moved into my 50s, and you become a little bit more aware of your physical limitations. In some cases, you become a lot more aware of your physical limitations as you move into middle age. And I really started to think a lot more about relaxation. It was something I hadn't given very much thought to when I was younger. And, you know, I'll give you some of the specific instances, you know, of relaxation. It's a general term, but you should really be thinking about relaxing specific things. So one of the things is we've always taught the importance of head position. And we told people, well, you know, put your head in line with your spine and put your head so you're looking down and put your head so it's mostly underwater and so on. And once I got into my 50s, I started to think of it and describe it differently. And by that I said, you know, I began to think about and to teach people to just release your head. Just, you know, when you're swimming, just completely relax the muscles that you normally use to hold it up. And that something that seemingly simple can be difficult for people because if they spent lots and lots of time holding the head in a certain position, at some point you're not even aware that you are, there's a certain degree of tension. So it can actually take people a long time to relax the head into position, all right? Another thing that we only have realized in the last couple of years, but turns out to be a really consequential issue, is what do you do with your hand? So I think we were all taught back in our, you know, Red Cross lessons and on swim teams and so on, the importance of holding water and the importance of pushing water. And how do you hold your hand when you want to hold water? Well, first we were taught to cup it, and then we were taught to turn it into a paddle and so on. No matter what, in every instance, what you're talking about is having a stiff hand. And as we were teaching, and we were watching a lot of video of swimmers who were unskilled and inefficient, we started to see a real pattern, which is whenever someone had a stiff hand, and how you can tell it's a stiff hand is really simple. Are the fingers held together? If the fingers are held together and the hand is stiff, almost without exception, as they extended it forward, as they reached out and extended it forward, the hand would scoop up. And as the hand scooped up, every single time the feet dropped. So it was kind of like the hand, the leading edge, as the arm went forward, if the hand was stiff, then the arm became like the front end of a kite. You know, if the front end of a kite catches the wind, the tail drops. And the water that you're moving through was acting like the wind that the kite is going through. So a stiff hand was actually causing people's feet to drop. And as soon as they relaxed the hand and the hand would just sort of drop, two things happened that were really beneficial. One is that the feet would come up and they wouldn't have to kick as much, and obviously that's beneficial. Beneficial because there's less drag when the feet come up, and it's beneficial because if you kick less, you're saving energy and you're also creating less turbulence. But the other thing was when the hand was dropping into a position where the fingers were down and the palm was back, well, then the first time they put any pressure on the water, the resultant force was moving them forward, whereas a stiff hand would have the arm straight or flat in front of you and the palm down, and the first pressure would move you upward instead. And those were kind of real, you know, pretty significant insights. And then, you know, from there it became a little more subtle for me in exploring my own swimming, and I started working with trying to figure out how light could be the pressure I applied to the water and yet not lose speed. So it moved from a general focus on relaxation to very specific instances of muscles that if you relax them, you would actually gain a benefit. So from that point, you know, we've gone to really looking at the whole body and every movement that happens in the course of the stroke and trying to figure out what are the muscles that people typically activate that are not productive. In other words, maybe they're even hurting your body position. Maybe, as in all the instances I gave, turning on muscles not only creates some fatigue in those muscles, but it hurts your body position. So, you know, it relaxation can be sort of a vague topic, and I think everyone understands that we perform better athletically when we're relaxed and when we're tense, but when you take it down to the details of swimming, there are some very consequential aspects of relaxation that actually make you a better swimmer. They not only save you energy, but they improve your ability to be efficient in the stroke.
Awesome. Great stuff. Okay. A lot of triathletes, you know, they don't like spending a lot of time in the pool. They often have limited time. And, you know, so they're looking to get the most bang for their buck when they're actually doing swimming. So how can a triathlete improve swimming endurance on with a limited training time?
Well, you know, that's a particularly important question for triathletes because they do have to, you know, they do have to make time for three sports as well as life. And, you know, and there is you know, there is a strong culture in triathlon about sort of the training log and making sure you're doing as much training as the next guy, and so on. And there's it's obviously not just triathlon, but the, you know, being fit, being conditioned, being ready for the task is something that is really important in swimming as well. And, you know, one of the things I always say to swimmers is that they don't give medals for the best VO2 max. You know, that performance, we get awarded for performance, and performance is really a function of doing movements that are effective. So, you know, if you're thinking of, am I getting enough time in the pool? Am I doing enough swimming? I think there are a few guidelines I can offer to sort of clear up that subject. And the first is to redefine endurance. And endurance we think of as the capacity to do work, and we think of it in a physiological sense. I kind of define endurance for swimming as the ability to repeat effective swimming movements, effective strokes, and to do that for a duration of your choosing, to do that at a rate of your choosing. That rate could be a stroke rate, it could be a heart rate or whatever, but it's a very specific task, and that means not just physiological or aerobic endurance, but it also means muscular endurance. It means that your nervous system must be trained well to repeat the movement patterns that are effective and to have those not break down. So I'm a really serious open water swimmer. You know, that while I was pretty much of an underachiever in my youth, since turning 55, I've won multiple national masters championships. I broke two national records in the 1 mile and 2 mile cable swims. I was the top ranked long distance swimmer in my age group in 2006 and 2007. And I have learned in my 50s that the muscular endurance I just spoke about, as well as mental endurance, are just as important to me as the physiological or aerobic endurance. And when I say mental endurance, it means that if I'm swimming 2 miles in open water, when I broke the record, I was swimming for 46 minutes, the duration of the 2 mile race, you know, where I broke the record, it was 46 minutes and 20 seconds. And I can tell you, during the 46 minutes and 20 seconds, I never got distracted one moment. I was probably taking somewhere between 60 and 65 strokes a minute for 46 minutes, as I said. And that's, you know, 2,600 or 2,700 strokes or something like that. Not for one stroke did I ever let my mind wander away from the stroke I was taking in that moment. And, you know, when we go back to that realization of what I said, which is that humans are catastrophically inefficient in the water, and that almost nothing we do instinctively or naturally is good, and almost everything that solves our efficiency problem is counterintuitive, is non-instinctive, you start to realize the importance of being really attentive and mindful to the details of your stroke while you're swimming. So when I'm training, I'm not just training for aerobic endurance. I'm far more likely to be thinking about and visualizing, and this will sound a little wacky to a lot of the members, but it's totally true. When I'm out in a lake, and I do for 5 months of the year between mid-May and mid-October, I don't swim in a pool, and I don't ever use a pace clock. I do every bit of my swimming in a lake, and so I'm not doing any timed intervals. But one of the things that lake swimming and open water swimming promotes, when you take away the walls, you take away the pace clocks, you take away all the stuff that's normally there in the pool, is what you're left with is your own stroke and your own sensations and so on. And so I have found myself often while out in the middle of the lake and working on
one fairly subtle detail of my stroke, just a sense of having my hand tipped in a certain way and my elbow lifted in a certain way at the beginning of the stroke and feeling the water resist my hand and forearm in that moment. And as I'm doing that, I'm taking 300, 400, 500 uninterrupted strokes because there are no walls. I just find myself drawn to this image of signals going along the wiring of my nervous system and going to a specific muscle and activating that muscle over and over and over until my nervous system really, really knows that movement. And so this is kind of a long-winded way of saying that I've devoted so much time to training my nervous system and devoted so much time to training my mind to stay focused on these little details that I have learned are consequential to whether I'm efficient or inefficient, my sense of endurance is much broader than it used to be. And I realize that, you know, I can accomplish so much more in a limited amount of training time by thinking more broadly about endurance and not just thinking about aerobic endurance.
All right, very interesting. All right, here's another topic that's kind of like, you know, you hear a lot of different things on, and that has to do with kicking. You know, as triathletes, people are told, oh, don't kick, it'll burn your legs out. Some people say kick a bunch, you know, do an 8-beat kick. Some say 2-beat kick. Some say don't kick at all. What's your opinion on that, and where do you stand on that?
All right, well, I'm going to try to give a less long-winded answer than the last one, you know, and I'll start by saying something really direct and specific. The first thing you should be thinking about with regard to your kick, and this goes back to that idea of being aware of drag, constantly aware of drag, is the first thing you should think about with your kick is how to move your legs and how to hold your legs so that they create less drag. All right, it's instinctive that when you're thinking about kicking, you're thinking about kicking to propel. You know, if you're on a kickboard, which I would say never ever do, it's the biggest waste of time. Not until they start offering races, triathlon races, where you've got to kick 400 meters before you get on your bike, which they're not going to do. All right,
yeah.
Until they do that, kicking on a kickboard is a waste of time. All right, so think first about streamlining your legs. That's the very first thing, all right? The second thing is it's really important to find a way to relax your legs. Here we go back to that concept of relaxation, and in this case, it means to make your legs more passive. And here what I'm talking about is what is so common among new swimmers and people who are taking up triathlon or have been runners and never swam before, and so on, is they get in the pool, they feel like they're sinking, and the first thing that happens is their legs just start churning. And it's not that they want to kick, it's they don't feel they can't kick. If they don't kick, they're going to sink. So the legs start churning. It is so critical to your success as a long-distance open water swimmer and your ability to get out of the water feeling fresh and have good, fresh legs when you get on the bike, that you be able to have relatively passive legs in the pool. So when we're teaching people how to kick so that their kick is beneficial and efficient and economical, we actually have them do a drill we call Superman Glide, where in a shallow section, whether it's, you know, in open water in the pool, in a shallow section, they repeatedly push off the bottom, extend their arms forward at shoulder width, and simply glide. And what they're trying to do is feel, even if it's brief, to feel a moment of support that sort of tells their brain something different. What they're used to hearing from their brain is, if I don't kick, I might drown. And we need to interrupt that signal and replace it with a signal that says, kick, I'm okay, all right? So they do the Superman glide and they feel a moment of support and they start to just let it relax a little bit. So you've got to break the cycle of what I call busy legs and let the legs be a little more passive. And then at some point Beyond that, you gain the ability, after swimming for a while with passive legs that do not have this habit of churning, that are not creating all this drag, by swimming for a while with legs that are passive, you break that cycle, and you then will have a chance after a while to start developing a coordinated two-beat kick. But it starts with, number one, being more conscious of streamlining the legs, and number two, of developing the balance and the sense of support, almost weightlessness, where you can have a relaxed passive leg movement that's non-overt.
All right. Good. Okay. With that, I'm going to ask you this. Is it, with triathletes, obviously we're swimming in the open water. And so basically, I want to know how much of a difference is there in technique or strategy between swimming in a triathlon versus swimming in, in a pool, maybe doing 100-meter race in the pool or something like that?
Huge difference. I've been swimming in open water since I was in my 20s. So I started around 1973. I was an ocean lifeguard on Long Island, and I went to lifeguard tournaments and started swimming ocean races, probably 34, 35 years ago. And I noticed early on that I was more successful in open water races than I was in the pool. People that typically beat me in the pool, I could either be competitive with them or even, beat them when I got in open water. And I just started to sort of think of myself as an open water specialist. So that was a long time ago. But then as I moved into my 50s, I started to set some higher goals. And I really, I moved into my 50s, and I was sort of on the verge of being in the race to win a national championship. I'd finished second a couple of times, but I'd never won. But I really, wanted to raise my level, and I wanted to be a national champion. I was so close, I could almost taste it. And I started to realize that if I was going to have any chance of actually being a national champion and doing these things that I've done since turning 55, it was not going to happen for me in the pool, but that there I really had a shot in open water. So I started practicing differently. And I'd been swimming masters for quite a few years, and I was swimming with a local group of masters. And I started to swim every practice repeat thinking about open water races that might be months in the future. And what I mean differently from what other people are doing, or distinct from what other people are doing, was that if we were swimming, say, 25s, and there were quite a few triathletes swimming with the group, that we were swimming 25s, everybody would sprint the 25s, and by sprint, I mean high stroke rate, really aggressive arm turnover, and so on. And they would just tear off, and I would swim the way I would swim in the faster part of an open water swim, which is a longer stroke, a controlled stroke, things that felt more sustainable, yet the fastest I could swim. So if they were taking 21 strokes on a 25, I was still limiting myself to 14 or 15 and just challenging myself to swim as fast as I could at 14 strokes, as fast as I could at 15 strokes. Now, my 25s, when I did that, would be slow by pool standards, but I wasn't worried about that. I was committed to being fast in an open water context, to constantly patterning myself, constantly programming myself for the kind of stroke that I knew by experience worked well in open water. And so I continued to do that, and, to some extent, I felt like I was limiting myself as a pool swimmer, but it brought me, just steadily increasing experience in open water. So I was convinced I was really onto something. And then 2 years ago, Jonty Skinner, who's the performance science director for USA Swimming, he wrote an article on the USA Swimming website. And if any of you listeners want to read that article, if you go to the USA Swimming website and look at the article section, and so on, you can find that article. But also, if you go to our website and you look in the archives of our magazine, I've written an article about the open water technique, which drew from Jonti's article. So basically, here's what Jonti's article talked about. He had done a study of swimmers that were really successful in 25-yard pools. You know, all through the winter, USA Swimming and the NCAA, they race in 25-yard pools. And then in the summer, the races are in 50-meter pools. And he found that there were quite a few swimmers that were very fast in 25-yard pools and didn't do well in long course in 50-meter pools. And when he studied them, he found that they swam differently. The people who were successful in 25-yard pools had an aggressive, high-rate arm-based stroke. There was a lot of force in the arm stroke and a high turnover and not a lot of body rotation. And the swimmers who were more successful in 50-meter pools were people who had a longer stroke, more body rotation. It was more of a core-based stroke. There were lower arm forces, all right, but the stroke they had was producing a speed that was more sustainable. And here's what was really striking to me in the article. He did an analysis of the difference between long course swimming and short course swimming. And in a 25-yard pool, the ratio of swimming to non-swimming, in other words, when you turn and push off and glide, and you know from watching the Olympics that swimmers are spending a lot more time underwater now, you know, with the dolphins and so on, and less time on the surface swimming. But the ratio between swimming and non-swimming in a 25-yard pool among elite athletes was 2.6 to 1. So they were actually spending a lot of time not swimming, all right? And the not swimming portion allowed them to recover from the really physically taxing stroke they were using on the surface. That stroke made them faster over short distances, but they were also able to recover for a substantial part of these races. In long course, that ratio went up to about 7 to 1 or 8 to 1. So with so much less recovery, it was evident that a different kind of a stroke, longer stroke, more body rotation, more based on core power, less load on the arms and so on, was hugely advantageous when you changed your ratio swimming to non-swimming from 2.6 to 1 to about 8 to 1. Now you get an open water, what have you got? No rest. It's all swimming. So I saw that article and I thought, oh my God, you know, what's true in long course has to be dramatically true when you get an open water. So at that point, I just realized that for about 5 years, I had, you know, sort of unawares been practicing a stroke that I recognized was advantageous in open water, and then I saw this confirmation, this proof, based in the study done by, as I said, the performance science director for USA Swimming. So basically, that's when I decided I needed to make a video. That's what this new video of ours, Outside the Box, is about. Is about illustrating and explaining the techniques that you are probably not likely to do if you've been training in a pool. And, you know, if you think about it, doesn't everybody do most of their swimming in a pool?
Yeah.
And don't most of them do, you know, don't an awful lot of triathletes, aren't they drawn to swim with masters teams? And when they get in with the masters team, are they not, you know, just being the good athletes, the dedicated athletes they are when the coach assigns 25s? They do their level best to race as well as they can on those 25s, you know. It doesn't matter whether it's a 25 or a 500. Being a devoted athlete, they're going to give their best. Mm. And so what's happening when you're doing what you think is, you know, is the right thing, doing the hard work that you think is the right thing, you're training yourself to be, you know, to basically to have a stroke that's going to hurt you in open water. So it becomes important to recognize the difference. There is a difference between a pool stroke, especially a 25-yard pool stroke, and most of us who are swimming there, and a stroke that's going to help you in open water. They're two really different ways of swimming. It's not just an issue of having good technique. It's an issue of having an open water technique. And that's what When that's what this video we just released is about. It explains the part one. There's three parts, but part one explains the open water technique and how to develop it. And you've got to work on it in the pool. You have to really be good in open water. You have to be in the pool in the middle of November or in the middle of December, that we are right now, and thinking about a race you're going to swim in June in open water, and be rehearsing for that race instead of racing through the repeat you're doing this minute in December in a pool.
All right. Well, very interesting stuff for sure. And like you said, he's got that new DVD that you can check out on his website for that. We're actually getting a lot of questions coming in over over the internet here. You want to try answering a few?
I love it.
Okay. All right. Let's do that. We got Fred Bowens here in Southfield. And you said my swim is improving.
At Southfield, Michigan?
I'm not sure. It just says Southfield. Maybe Michigan, possibly. I don't know. He says, do you know him?
No, I'm just curious.
All right.
Click and clack. They always want to know where you're from. Yeah,
he's Southfield. So I'm sure there's a few of those in America. But you say my swim is improving, but I'm a sinker. Any extra advice there?
Yeah, I would recommend that he try that Superman glide exercise that I did. Sinking is not bad. Sinking is what we're supposed to do. Our bodies are designed to sink, all right? So actually trying to stay on top of the water is counterproductive because it leads to struggle, and it definitely hurts you. Fish are underwater, are they not? There's less drag below the surface. So the human body is really, by body composition, is supposed to be 95% below the surface. So balance is really learning to sink in a horizontal position, and that's what that Superman glide drill that I described teaches you, is how to sink in a horizontal position until you reach equilibrium, until you reach a place where you feel support. That's also taught in lesson one on our Easy Freestyle DVD. So doing balance drills and learning to sink horizontally instead of fighting gravity is a really important thing.
All right. Next question we got Mario from Chihuahua, Mexico, and his question is it
better... Hola, Mario!
There we go. And his question is it better to practice technique applying your concepts only with no tools, or mix that technique practice with technique using tools such as fins, kickboards, and paddles?
You know, I'm really not a fan of tools, and the reason that I gave is probably, if I go back to Fred's question about sinking and so on, is fins and paddles and kickboards and all the, and all these things. Think about it. What are they all focused on? They're all focused on, number one, work. They're forms of work. They're just different forms of work. They're forms of work. They're forms of getting muscle strong. And they're all about propulsion, aren't they? Is there anything about any of those tools that is about being aware of avoiding drag? I don't think so. So if you go back to that awareness, and it's going back to base principles. An awareness of a base principle, such as the ones I started out. Swimmers are 3% efficient. Human swimmers are 3% efficient. The number one reason why they're 3% efficient is drag. If you go back to those base principles, it will answer almost any question you have. So think about improving your efficiency. Think about reducing energy waste. Think about reducing drag. You don't have enough time in your life to solve all these problems in the water, let alone wasting time going up and down the pool with fins and paddles and kickboards.
Huh. All right. And that was Southfield, Michigan, by the way. That's what they're saying.
Okay.
They let me know. All right. Next we got Fred Goss from Oakland, California, and he says,
I know Fred Goss.
You know Fred?
I know Fred Goss. I've exchanged email with him.
All right. Well, he's got a question for you. He's saying, Terry, I'm an Ironman, but it's hard to get in open water to train. How is it best to use a 25-meter or yard pool for Ironman training?
Okay, well, I think that goes back to what I said before, is to recognize that when you're in a yard pool, you don't want to train like a 25-yard swimmer, like I described before. Certainly, you know, a yard pool or a meter pool is a great place to practice technique. It's a great place to practice the development of mental endurance by really focusing on your strokes. So it's developing the techniques of open water swimming. I can name a few of them here that they're illustrated on the video. But number one is release your head. I talked about that earlier. You want to let your head go until it's in a neutral position. Number two is what I call wide tracks. You want to make sure your arms never cross over in front. That as you extend your arms, they should extend and pull back at shoulder width. Because if the arms cross over the center line, it makes you less stable side to side. Whereas arms that stay wider are a little bit like outriggers, and they make you more stable side to side. Number three among those techniques is what we call the mail slot entry. You visualize a letter slot, the kind that the mailman puts the letters in your front door. You visualize a mail slot in the water, and you slip your hand cleanly into that slot in such a way that your forearm and elbow can go through that slot. And the fourth one is again that idea that I mentioned before of keeping your legs streamlined and relatively passive. There's more to it than that. As I said, the Easy Freestyle video and the Outside the Box video both illustrate the specifics and a lot more details about how to develop them, but certainly the starting point is, if you are in a 25-yard pool, be thinking about how you want to swim in open water and be working on those techniques.
All right. We got Hal from Bloomfield, Michigan. And he is saying, it seems that total immersion concentrates so much on form that it gives up speed for efficiency. How do you increase speed using your technique?
Great question. I think of speed in two ways. All right, when you're in that 3%, 4%, and maybe even 5% range of efficiency, and I know that, you know, nobody out there is going to know exactly what their number is, but if you're still sort of a developing swimmer, you know, most of the speed that you gain initially is going to come from what I call sustainability. By sustainability, it means that a pace that you might be able to hold for 100 meters or 200 meters, as you increase your efficiency, as you decrease the energy cost, that pace then becomes one you can extend to 200 meters, to 400 meters, to 800 meters, to 1.5K and so on. So sustainability, the ability to hold a given pace that used to tire you out after a short while, and then being able to sustain that pace longer, that should always be the first place that more speed comes from. And the second place, and I would invite people to go to our site after this talk to visit the Total Immersion site and read my blog from today, because I just put a blog up today about exactly this question, which is using a tempo trainer, all right, once you have an efficient stroke, to use a tempo trainer to incrementally increase the rate at which you take those strokes, all right? So I'll give you a real quick, for instance, of using a tempo trainer. My training session yesterday was, I did 425s, 450s, 475s, 4100s, 4125s, that's five lengths of the pool. And then I did 4100s, 475s, 450s, and 425s. I had a tempo trainer under my cap the whole time. I set the tempo trainer at 1.2 seconds, which means I was going to take a stroke every 1.2 seconds in response to a beep, or synchronized to a beep that I heard beneath my cap from the tempo trainer. All right, and I simply maintained a constant stroke count. I've spent a lot of years working on my stroke efficiency and my ability to maintain a constant count. But I maintained a constant count of of 13 strokes on the first lap of every repetition and 14 strokes thereafter. And I did that from the 25 going up to the 125. As I came down, and the effect of that means that my pace per lap on the 125 was exactly the same as it was on the 25. I gave up no pace as the distance increased. So that's the sustainability side of speed. So the first half of that set, I was working on the sustainability side of speed. On the second half of the set, as I dropped from the 125s to the 100s, I increased the frequency of the beeps. I adjusted the tempo trainer, so it was now beeping every 1.19 seconds instead of every 1.2 seconds. It's a hundredth of a second. It's a tiny, tiny interval of time. But the great thing was, if I took 13 strokes, 14 strokes, 14 strokes, on that, there was about 80 beeps or so in the course of 100. So I was actually swimming a second faster, just by changing it by a hundredth of a second. I swam my hundred a second faster, by 80 beeps multiplied by 1/100th of a second. And so learning to gradually adjust the rate at which you complete strokes of high efficiency is the second part of it. Speed is a math problem, and very few people think about this. Virtually everybody thinks about speed as I have to swim harder to go faster. And in order to swim harder, I have to be fitter, so I have to work harder to swim harder to go faster. And that's not it. Speed is a pure math problem. All right, it's the distance of a stroke multiplied by the rate by which you take them. So first establish the distance of your strokes, then use a tempo trainer to, in a methodical, systematic, and controlled way, gradually, incrementally increase the rate at which you take them. And it's simply a training thing. You're training your nervous system to be able to handle different rates. You do that on your bicycle with cadence meters and so on. You don't do it in the pool. You need to start doing it in the pool. And if they read my blog from yesterday's training, I just posted it today, they'll see a really detailed account of how to do that in practice.
Okay. So one of the other questions that's coming up here is there an ideal stroke count per 25 yards or anything like that people should be aiming for?
Yes, but it's not the same. It's not one count fits all, right?
Yeah.
It really is a factor of your height. It's a factor of your arm length and so on. The most important thing is that the lowest count you use at any time should be no strain. By no strain, I mean you're not extending yourself in an unnatural way. You're not kicking to get that low count and so on. So stroke count is really less important than just finding a way of swimming easily. And as you find a way to swim easily, yes, by all means, count your strokes and use that as a cross-reference, and over time, be committed to doing the changes in technique that allow you to swim with ease at a gradually lower stroke count, but don't obsess about getting a low count. I have a formula, for what's the optimal stroke count for a person of any height, and I promise I will blog on that tomorrow. So if they look at my blog, I will put on my blog that formula by which anybody can measure their arm length and know what is the optimal low count for them.
Excellent. I'm sure you'll have a lot of people checking that out. And we're going to go with one more question. And this is from Lewis Starp in West Point. And he says, is there a simple
way... He's the coach of the West Point Triathlon team.
Is he?
One of the best collegiate teams in the nation.
They're good. Shout out to you, Lewis. All right. Is there a simple way to dramatically show someone how to let me read that over. I blew that. All right. Is there a simple And I just scrolled, I'll find it here. I just scrolled on it, didn't mean to. Basically, he was saying, is there a way to show someone the importance of drag reduction versus propulsion?
Is there a way to show them the importance of drag reduction versus propulsion?
Yeah,
I would. Here's a really simple way. Push off the wall, and streamline. All right, and have someone time you. Have someone time you with a push off, and just swim like halfway down the pool. All right. And then do it without the push-off, where you push off right on the surface and start stroking right away, all right? So if you push off, hold your glide underwater, all right? Break out outside the flags. Let's say you go 5 or 6 yards, and then swim halfway down or to the other end of the pool and have someone time you, all right? Then you'll have a combination of drag reduction and propulsion in the course of that swim. If you push off right on the surface and start stroking right away, it'll all be propulsion. Guaranteed the first wave will be much faster, and that's a really simple way to understand the difference. And I should put in a plug. Lou wrote a book chronicling the coaching he did with the West Point Tri Team called The Overachiever's Diary, and it's an account of a full season of training by the West Point Triathlon team with a real particular emphasis on how they developed as swimmers.
All right. Well, good stuff. Well, Terry, that is all the time we have for this evening. Thank you for coming out and sharing all kinds of great knowledge with everyone there. And that's basically
it. I enjoyed it, as you could probably tell. It was great fun.
I can tell. You're very passionate about it, and that's what we love to have on.
Excellent. Okay.
Excellent.
Well, thanks to everybody for dropping in and joining us tonight.
Yeah.
I'll see you all online.
That's right, and we'll be here next Tuesday again at 8 p.m., and looking forward to having you, and next week we're actually going to have Brendan Brazier on, and so we're looking forward to having that on, and that is basically it. Everyone have a great night, and I'll talk to you in the future.
Okay.
The moderator has disconnected.